Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Emergency and Critical Care Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, American and RCVS specialist in emergency and critical care medicine, Lindsay Kellett-Gregory. Thank you, Lindsay. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Well, welcome everybody to this webinar, which is entitled, Where Did All the Platelets Go and How Do I Get Them Back? And what we're going to try and aim to do during this webinar is to cover these areas I've listed here. So to go through why we think a given patient might be bleeding, how to get to the bottom of all of the various different types of coagulopathies and hone in on it being a platelet issue. Talk about the general approach to any sort of bleeding patient, but then I wanted to spend the most time talking about common causes of thrombocytopenia in our small animal patients, what they're caused by and how we hopefully go ahead and fix them. So to set the scene for our discussion of platelet disorders today, here's a case that we've most likely seen in its entirety or a very similar one in our own practices. So a young Springer Spaniel comes into us with a history of bleeding from the mouth earlier in that morning, and it seems like something's progressing and there's now a bruise being noticed on the abdomen as well. And when we do our physical exam, we find that there's some petechiation on the mucosal surfaces of the mouth. And when we then go ahead and look at this dog and part the fur, we can see similar findings on the skin over several sites on the body. So it seems like there's bleeding at several distinct sites in this patient. And so if we want to start understanding why a patient like Jazz might be bleeding, it's really helpful to have just a brief review of what normal clotting actually is, so then we can go ahead and see where it might go wrong. And traditionally, we thought of hemostasis as occurring in two processes that occur sequentially. So the primary hemostasis, where we have an injury to a blood vessel wall and we have a small platelet plug that's formed, and that's a very platelet-oriented part of clotting. And then the secondary hemostasis comes in after that, as this model sort of says, where we have the clotting cascade, we've got lots of enzymes being activated, and ultimately end up with this fibrin plug being formed that's much stronger, and that's the thing that seals the deal. There's also the process afterwards of fibrinolysis, of how the body deals with getting rid of that clot once the bleeding has been stopped. But in terms of the actual clotting side of things, we tend to think about primary and secondary hemostatic things. And actually, it turns out, sort of given modern findings, that this is quite an old way of thinking about it. And in reality, as we can probably appreciate, it's a lot more complicated than just this. And it turns out there's quite a lot of overlap between the stages. But the reason I mention this today in the terms of normal coagulation is that this fits a lot better with our understanding of how patients bleed, the types of bleeding patterns they have, and how we go about coming up with a diagnostic plan to get to the bottom of it. So it suits our purposes quite well today to think about primary and secondary hemostatic problems. If we start with the primary problem itself, the figure here shows how a platelet plug forms. So basically, if we have any injury to the vascular endothelium, as denoted by the hole in the middle of this slide here, then we get exposure of the materials underneath that normal endothelium, and one of those really important ones is collagen. And that does a couple of things which help stop the bleeding. So it causes some reflex vasoconstriction, so we get less blood flow to the area, so there's less blood loss capability, which is quite helpful. But it's that collagen exposure that sets off the actual clotting and that primary hemostasis, that primary platelet plug formation. And so we get some von Willebrand's factor happens to be floating by that connects those initial platelets to the collagen. And then it sets off a sequence really whereby we have platelets release activating substances which attract more platelets to the area, cause them to stick together, and then we end up with our primary platelet plug and hopefully a cessation in that bleeding from the area too. And so it makes sense that if we if we're going to have this primary platelet plug formed, then we need to have platelets to be present in the correct numbers, and we also need them to be working properly. And so if there's any breakdown in that system whereby there's inadequate platelet numbers or inadequate platelet function, then we can't form that plug very effectively, and that's when we end up with our clinical bleeding problem. Something that's actually quite handy when we're dealing with the patients actually on the clinic floor is that the clinical features of bleeding that we tend to see with either primary or secondary hemostatic problems are quite significantly different. And so just based on physical exam and looking at the bleeding pattern can be really useful to tell us the likely origin of any sort of systemic bleeding disorder. And so if they've read the textbook, which thankfully the vast majority of patients presenting with coagulopathies have, patients with a primary hemostatic disorder, so that being one affecting platelets, typically show petechiation and potentially ecchymoses, but the major feature is that it's mucosal surface bleeding. So we'll see epistaxis, GI bleeding, bleeding from the urinary system, bleeding in the lungs, bleeding on the eyes. And often we see it at several multiple sites, as we saw with Jazz, our case example today, that we've got it on the gums and the skin at a different site. And if we do have any wounds present, whether those be accidental from the patient or potential surgical or other interventions that we've done on the patient, we can see prolonged and repeated bleeding from those wounds as a feature of primary hemostatic disorder bleeding. By contrast, as a means of a refresher, secondary hemostasis consists of this traditional coagulation cascade that we talked about, where ultimately we've got lots of sequential enzymatic reactions, and we get this cross-linked fibrin clot formed right down at the bottom there that's much stronger and hopefully will cause the bleeding to stop in its entirety. And if we think about bleeding patterns that we see when there's a failure of this system, we can see that they are quite different in that we'll tend to see larger bleeds, which I guess makes a lot of sense. If we don't have this strong fibrin clot being formed, it tends to create a larger bleed. And often that's manifest in the form of hematoma formation or bleeding into body cavities, which could be anywhere. Could be hemiperitoneum or even the retroperitoneum, into the pleural space, the pericardial space, joints, etc. And of note, even though this is a systemic bleeding disorder, it's not uncommon that we'll just see bleeding in one site with this. So for example, just the peritoneal cavity or just a joint. And the bleeding may be delayed in onset as well. So after some kind of injury or insult or issue that creates a problem with secondary hemostasis, it might be a period of days before those clotting factors are used up potentially, and then we see the patient presenting to us bleeding. So how do we approach the average bleeding patient, if you like? Just as a very brief refresher, any patient who has a bleeding disorder could present it with a life-threatening bleed, could be an absolute emergency. And so we'll start with our usual major body systems assessment, triaging these patients and stabilizing them as necessary, typically using fluids to treat any hypovolemic shock, and just getting them to the point where they're stable enough for us to look into this a bit more. The next thing to do is to assess this bleeding pattern, as we've mentioned, to see if it's most likely primary or secondary. And if we're hunting for a site of bleeding, then those are good places to look. And we can use emergency ultrasound, of course, to look for any cavity bleeds that might not be immediately apparent. But then we'll think about going on to some more targeted diagnostics. So looking at our Paxa volume and total solids to assess for any anemia or look for any characteristic changes that would be consistent with hemorrhage. Looking at a blood smear to look for platelets that we'll talk about shortly. Thinking about coagulation testing, so assessing PT and PTT, especially if we think it's a secondary hemostatic issue. And depending on the area you're practicing in, whether or not you think it's a prevalent condition, certainly assessing for lungworm. Where I work, it's pretty common as a cause of surprising bleeding, so it's something that we'll check early on. And then we can avoid the problem getting worse and then think about later on looking for additional diagnostic tests as indicated to get to the bottom of things. And so given the topic of the webinar today is all things platelet, we'll talk about how we assess a patient's primary hemostatic function. So we can see very early on in these guys if it is implicated in any bleeding. Essentially, we said it came down to the platelet count and the platelet function. And the handy thing about assessing platelet count is that it's something that's pretty easy for us to do, whether that be running the blood through an automated hematology analyzer, or whether it be looking at a blood smear to actually count the platelets ourselves and get a really quick and easy viewpoint as to what our platelets are up to. It is important to say that when we're considering the presence of thrombocytopenia, it's really important for us to think about whether the platelet count that we're reading or getting is low enough to be causing clinical bleeding of its own accord, and as such, whether the patient is at risk of spontaneous bleeding. The exact number when that happens is variable depending on where you read in the literature, but as a common consensus, a lot of people put that at around the 30 to 50,000 platelets per litre mark. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that every patient's different, and there's also a difference between a patient who's just sitting there doing a normal things in their day-to-day life in terms of their risk of spontaneous bleeding versus the patient who we're about to challenge their hemostasis, maybe by doing a surgery or you know, creating a wound or taking a biopsy or something similar. And in those patients, there's a risk of spontaneous bleeding at higher platelet counts. Somewhere again variable depending where we read, but maybe more like 60 to 80,000. So not so black and white, but I guess the important point is once we've got our platelet number to start thinking about how relevant is that to the patient in front of us. And so we said we can use a hematology analyzer such as the one that we can see here, the NICE laser sight. Of course other ones are available to get a really good analysis as to what our platelet count is. And that's easy to do. We get other information as well, so we can start looking at what our other blood cell lines are doing too, so it gets us lots of information. But it is really important that we interpret these numbers with caution, because it does sometimes throw up some erroneous results that might set us off on the wrong pathway if left unchallenged. The problem is that these analyzers don't necessarily account for platelet clumping or the size of the platelets, and we can get falsely elevated or decreased counts, especially I think we've probably all seen this in cats where their platelets are phenomenally good at clumping, and it's uncommon for a cat not to appear thrombocytopenic on a hematology readout some days. And so it's, yes, they can be useful, but if we're suspecting that a patient could have thrombocytopenia, it's worth us checking a blood smear anyway, just so we can make sure that we are ruling out some of those otherwise complicating factors. And so it does raise a point that if our primary reason for running these tests is to look for a decrease in platelets, it may be worth just doing a blood smear right off once we kind of get confident at doing that, just to save a bit of money and get the information we actually need straight off. Looking at blood smears, there's lots of sort of online resources to talk through how to make a blood smear if that isn't something that you feel comfortable or confident with at this point. But once we've made one that's hopefully of good diagnostic quality, it's really important that we're going to look at this accurately so our information is as accurate as it can be and actually better than the hematology analyzer is producing. And one of the most important things to do to increase the accuracy is to make sure that we're evaluating that blood smear for the presence of platelet clumps. And there's a couple of places we're going to look for that. So at the feathered edge of the blood smear, right where the blood smear kind of tails off at that beautiful, hopefully bullet-shaped smear that we've made. And we look at that at low power, and that's usually pretty easy to see. I've got some pictures on the next slide. But also in the monolayer of the smear as well, as we can see in the picture on the right of the slide here, looking for any clumping throughout there that could otherwise affect our platelet count negatively. In terms of knowing what normal is, and in dogs and cats, normally a platelet count is between 8 and 15 platelets per high power field. So this is once we're in the monolayer, we've got that the highest lens on, usually under oil immersion. And then we're typically looking at an average of around 10 fields and coming up with what the average is. And as I say, normal is between sort of 8 and 15 platelets in that field. This is quite a useful thing to know because given we said that spontaneous hemorrhage is unlikely unless the platelet counts is quite significantly low, if we're using that sort of 30 to 50,000 cutoff, then we can effectively say that if we're doing actual platelet counts per high power field, then that's looking at a platelet count of less than between 2 and 3 on average platelets per high power field. So straight away we can look at that number and really eyeball it and get an idea as to whether or not the platelets are implicated very quickly. And if we feel more comfortable working in absolute platelet counts as opposed to platelets per high power field, then it's an easy conversion to convert the average count to the estimated count simply by multiplying by 15,000 as well. So it can be quite a useful trick, and so ultimately we end up with the same and actually better information that we often do from running a normal hematology profile. Talking about platelet clumping as being important, I wanted to include a couple of figures here to really kind of show that clearly. We said that it can be present in lots of places, and the picture on the left is of a platelet clump in the at the feathered edge. So there's quite a lot of them all sort of grouped together in those sort of dribs and drabs of cells that are sort of dragged out to the far edge of the blood smear. And then on the right, we can see quite nice platelet clumps throughout the monolayer there. And if we see those straight away, we can say we're not going to be able to get an accurate platelet count or an estimate of the platelet count from the blood smear. But as an even better shortcut, we can say that if we simply, by having these large platelet clumps be present, it makes spontaneous bleeding solely due to the presence of thrombocytopenia pretty unlikely. Because if there's enough platelets to clump, then there should be enough platelets to afford some hemostasis to that patient too. So moving on to sort of the body of this talk that I wanted to cover today. Moving on to causes of thrombocytopenia or a low platelet count. There can be quite a few different causes, as we'll go over for the rest of the time we have today. But rather than trying to memorize a whole bunch of different things, I personally find it easier to try and group the disorders in some way according to the mechanism by which they lead to thrombocytopenia. So probably one of the ones we'll be most familiar with is the immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, where we've got immune-mediated destruction. And that's probably the most common acquired primary hemostatic defect in dogs. It's certainly very likely we'll see these cases in our sort of small animal practice patients. But of course, we can also lose or not have enough platelets from other causes. So if they're not being made as they should be normally in the bone marrow because of some disorder there. If they're being sequestered elsewhere in the body, typically splenic disease is one of the big things that we think about there. Or if they're just being consumed in excess of the rate at which the bone marrow can produce them. So they're being used up with hemorrhage or vasculitis or neoplasia or those sorts of things. So we'll aim to cover these sorts of causes in more detail throughout the rest of the webinar. What I would say is that before we get carried away and start thinking through our list of causes of thrombocytopenia, it's really worth just sitting back for a second and just making sure we're convinced that the thrombocytopenia is a real finding, and making sure that we haven't missed any platelet clumps, that we've really looked for those, and make sure that our sample hasn't clotted before we've analyzed it, and so the platelets haven't been consumed in vitro. So it's much nicer to solve a problem that wasn't really there. And so if we can eliminate thrombocytopenia as a problem just by verifying these sorts of things early on, it can save a lot of time and money of not barking up the wrong tree, so to speak. There are a couple of other situations where the platelet count may appear lower on initial screening of looking at these sorts of blood smears or hematology readouts than it actually is, and it seems like a problem when it's not. One of these I wanted to mention today was this disorder, if you like, called macrothrombocytopenia, which it's relatively common in our Cavalier King Charles Spaniels, but can occur in other breeds as well. Actually really quite common within the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel population, more so than you might think. So if we go and look for this, we'll probably find it in a fair few of the patients that we see of that breed. But what we're actually seeing here is it's where affected dogs do have decreased numbers of platelets on their blood smear. But when we go ahead and actually look at them in a bit more detail, we can see that those platelets that are there are much larger than they should normally be and really quite visible. And so a sort of an example of them, this would be on the smear we have here. So we can see that this really quite large spherical or sort of ovoid shaped structure is actually a platelet. And that's actually much larger than it should be. These macroplatelets end up being equal to a larger than red cell, so much, much larger than they should normally be. And when we go ahead and do the count in these patients, then the decrease in platelet numbers can be really quite marked. So occasionally down in the territory, we might be concerned about spontaneous bleeding in the sort of 30,000 mark. More commonly, it tends to be reduced, but not less than 100,000. So it can be variable, but not usually too severe in the vast majority of patients. The reason I mention this is it doesn't really matter if they have it, is because even though these patients do have less platelets than they would according to a sort of normal reference range, if you like, if we were to go ahead and sort of line them up and work out the total platelet volume or sort of the total surface area that these platelets are taking up, it's actually normal because, yes, there's less platelets, but the ones there are bigger. So we tend to think about hemostasis as sort of being more influenced by the total sort of platelet volume present. And so these dogs pass on a technicality, if you like. And so we don't tend to see clinical bleeding associated with this. This is just a normal finding in these dogs. They're absolutely fine. They don't bleed spontaneously. They don't bleed because of this if they're challenged by a surgery or something. And so if we do see clinical bleeding in a patient, we can be pretty sure that it's not because of this. Another reason for mentioning it, though, is that it does mean if we have this condition present, then automated counts are definitely going to be unreliable because these macroplatelets are the same size as red blood cells and are often inadvertently classified as red blood cells. And so actually it makes the platelet seem even worse than it actually is. So another reason just for verifying that and assessing the sort of overall number, but also size of the red cells present. And then, as we're probably familiar with, of course, greyhounds do their own thing a lot of the time. And normal greyhounds can often have a mild thrombocytopenia. So again, their platelet counts aren't usually less than 100,000. And it just seems to be a feature of them. We don't necessarily know why that happens. There's some talk that it could be a compensatory thing to try and prevent excessive thrombosis, or maybe it's because they're normally sort of viscous anyway with their red cells, or maybe it's because their bone marrow is so busy sort of making red cells that the platelets come up second best. But again, it's a normal variant and shouldn't cause clinical bleeding in these patients. And so, if moving on, if we confirm that the thrombocytopenia is actually real, then assuming that the patient is stable enough, then we're starting thinking about the next steps for investigating this problem. Hematology is quite useful at this point because it allows us to assess those other cell lines, the red cells and white cells, and to check that they're not affected in any way. That might clue us in to say that there could be a bone marrow problem as a productor issue of the platelets. Although if we get more comfortable with looking at blood smears, then that's something that we can judge from that as well. We can then look at performing other diagnostic tests to look for any evidence of platelet consumption or sequestration elsewhere in the body, whether that be on physical exam, imaging, testing for various infectious diseases that we'll talk about later that could fit the remit for those sort of pathophysiology. And also check for standard coagulation testing, not because we necessarily would think that that was related to the thrombocytopenia as a sort of cause of the bleeding, but if there has been significant bleeding because of a platelet disturbance, then it's possible we could have used up or consumed other clotting factors and therefore we might have more problems than we started with. So that could be a good screen to kind of look for consequences of any sort of significant platelet bleed. And ultimately, what we're trying to do with these diagnostics is to rule out everything else that could be a cause. And if we find nothing, then we can say we're more likely to have immune-mediated disease, which is really a diagnosis of exclusion more so. One thing that I did want to mention here was that if we think about blood cell lines being affected, then we might well start to think about is bone marrow sampling or investigation indicated. And it's not something that necessarily fills me with joy that I have to do a sort of bone marrow aspirate on a dog with sort of 0 to 1 platelets that I have sort of assess. So is it actually necessary? And the good news is that if we have severe thrombocytopenia, in a nutshell, probably not. And this is backed up by the evidence. So there's this nice little study where, albeit retrospectively, they look back to a bunch of dogs who had thrombocytopenia, of which a lot of them had quite severe thrombocytopenia as defined by less than sort of 20,000 platelets in terms of their platelet count. And they looked to see, was a bone marrow sample useful? Did it change what they did? And the answer was, for severe cases, it really didn't. And so if taking that forward, I think we can probably apply that to our patients, that if the platelet count is severely low, a bone marrow is unlikely to sort of change what we find. And maybe it's a test that's better reserved for patients with potentially other blood cell lines affected, or sort of more of a mild to moderate thrombocytopenia. They're more likely to get more diagnostic aspirates in that case. So I wanted to spend a bit of time talking about immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, or ITP as it's often abbreviated, because as we said, it's one of the most common acquired primary hemostatic defects that we see in dogs. Can be seen in cats too, of course, but less commonly. And as a refresher, we're talking about a very similar pathophysiology to IMHA, apart from that it's affecting the platelets, whereby the immune system is, for whatever reason, inappropriately targeting its own platelets for destruction. We know that can be primary or secondary in origin. So primary or idiopathic disease is that we just don't know why it's happened, or we haven't found out why, but most of the time we generally just don't know why. It just seems to be one of those things. But we know that there are a whole bunch of secondary causes, whereby something else in the body is triggering the immune system to go awry. And this isn't by any means an exclusive list of things, but it does mean that if we're suspicious of thrombocytopenia, and as part of that sort of workup to exclude other causes, we do end up on a bit of a fishing trip, for want of a better phrase, to look for anything at all that could be underlying this as a problem. For the reason that if it's there, we'll need to address it before we can hope to get the immune-mediated disease under control. And also that may well impact our prognosis quite significantly. For example, if we find something like neoplasia, that could well bring down our expected survival rate. The general kind of principles of treating ITP, as you said, sort of treating the underlying cause and any concurrent disease to get that out of the way and stop that upsetting the immune system. And then it's a case of non-specifically suppressing the immune system. So we'll talk about the different agents, but as a general rule, steroids and corticosteroids are going to be the way forward. Transfusion therapy as necessary. May well depend on the kind of patient populations you're seeing as to whether or not your patients with ITP have significant clinical bleeding that warrant transfusion, but we'll talk about kind of when to give that in some select patients. And then it seems to be clinician preference as to whether or not people use gastroprotectants in these patients as a rule while they're being immunosuppressed. There's no evidence to say that they're necessarily helpful or have any benefit, but do you have the potential for adverse reactions, and it's another drug being administered to a patient with an upset immune system that it could react to. And then if there's reason to be suspicious of infectious diseases, whether that be known tick exposure or travel history, or simply while we're pending infectious disease titer testing, then it's not inappropriate to treat our canine patients again with sort of doxycycline while we're waiting. So the steroids were the mainstay of treatment for ITP, and they really, the reason being is that they're very good at suppressing the immune system on a variety of levels, whether that be the sort of proliferation and of the lymphocytes or antibody production, or how various cells are being destroyed. So they seem to work, they're cheap, and so they are the mainstay of treatment. And we use them at the sort of the doses that we've got written up here. So we're talking about immunosuppressive doses. One thing I would say about the dose, however, is that we do see some large breed dogs with ITP. And if treating those larger dogs, it may be more appropriate, rather than using a mg per kg per day dosing strategy, to think about dosing on a body surface area to prevent the use of excessively high doses that are just going to give us side effects, as we've sort of listed here, as opposed to giving us any additional clinical benefit. And so it's something I'll tend to do for larger patients, but as a general rule in sort of the large breeds, I'm usually mindful to not exceed a sort of total of 60 milligrams of prednisolone daily in those large patients, which if I'm using the body surface area calculation, I'm probably not going to get up there anyway. And of course, if our patient isn't eating, is systemically unwell, we're worried about GI absorption for oral medications, we can always use dexamethasone as an alternative too. Something I did want to mention was the use of vincristine in these patients, because it may well be a drug that some people are using, but it may well be a drug that others aren't. So I thought it was worth mentioning today. And there's a potential rationale for using this drug as a single one-off dose in patients with confirmed ITP. For the reason that it has been shown quite effectively to increase platelet counts in these dogs. There's a bit of controversy as to how that actually happens, which is kind of interesting. So I think the previous thought was that vincristine caused the release of new platelets from the megakaryocytes in the bone marrow. Other people thought that it impaired phagocytosis of these sort of opsonized platelets by affecting sort of macrophage function. But actually, it seems more like a sort of Trojan horse mechanism tends to happen, is that certainly we know that in people and in dogs that are given vincristine, it binds to the microtubules in the circulating platelets that are going round. And because by virtue of the fact we've got ITP, there aren't actually many platelets going round. And so the ones that are there have this very high concentration of vincristine that get internalized in them. It's almost like then that poisons those platelets. So once those vincristine-loaded platelets are phagocytosed by the macrophages, it effectively kills off those macrophages and almost causes something sort of what you could describe as like a chemical splenectomy in some way. So it's quite an effective way of targeting just that specific immune reaction. We seem to say it's a one-off dose, and we give that along with steroids, and we just need to make sure that it actually is given intravenously, so we're not causing any tissue necrosis or sloughing if it goes perivascularly. How effective actually is it? Well, there is this study, came out a little while back, so around sort of 2002, that looked at the use of vincristine in dogs with ITP. It's a nice design. They looked at dogs who received just prednisolone alone and those who use vincristine and prednisolone. So it really teased out the vinc effect quite nicely. And what this study showed is that this sort of one-off dose that we talked about, it really sped up the recovery of platelet count when it was given on the day of diagnosis to these dogs with ITP. Quite significantly, so we're talking, if you look at the numbers on this sort of results section, we're talking about a mean of 4.9 versus 6.8 days, which in my clinic probably represents a significant increase in expense, which of course we know in our patients can affect outcome as well. And a nice thing was that they, it had an effect on length of hospitalization, and they also, there was another study that showed it decreased blood transfusion requirements, which has to be a good thing as well. Interestingly, they also showed that they did have another group of dogs in this study who received vincristine later. So they'd been in prednisolone for a week, and then on day 7 they hadn't responded and were given a dose of vincristine then. And the positive effect was seen even when it was delayed. So it doesn't have to be at the front or never. Seems like it could have a place later on too. And the other really nice thing was that they really didn't show any adverse effects attributable to the vincristine in this study as well. So because of the potential benefits, and because we know the bleeding with this disease can be really quite severe and costly to treat, it seems like if we have a drug that we know can speed up recovery, then it's probably advisable to be used as a sort of mainstay of therapy in our patients with confirmed ITP. Is there any rationale or any role for any other agents? To be honest, not usually. So I guess with IMHA and sort of the similar condition, then we'll think about adding in additional immunosuppressive therapy to try and reduce steroid requirements. But the clinical progression with dogs with ITP is often that they are usually successfully weaned off steroids in 4 months or less. So it's less of a sort of pressing factor. Lots of agents listed out there as sort of evidence in this purple box, but there isn't really any veterinary evidence on any of them as an effective second-line agent, so we're sort of choosing in the dark if we go with one. And sometimes we may think about it would be if we've had treatment failure just with steroids, we're just not getting there, or if we've had a relapse, some reason why the patient can't have steroids or the side effects of steroids are too much. I think a lot of the time we think this is really bad, we'll add in a second agent, but actually wouldn't necessarily address the sort of the root of the problem and give us a response in a timely fashion. So as a general rule, second line agents not usually needed. But I did want to mention this as a sort of relevant study at this juncture. So there was this study, or this sort of case series, I guess, of five dogs where they had confirmed ITP and they were treated with solely mycophenolate as a single agent. So these dogs didn't receive corticosteroids at all. They felt they were contraindicated because they'd been on various non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs chronically. And they received mycophenolate at the sort of standard doses as a sole agent. And they found that they had these dogs do really quite well, that they got remission in all of the dogs, and they were able to discontinue the therapy after a few months. So that's potentially quite positive. And I think it's worth bearing in mind for those sort of special cases. But of note, the dogs in this study weren't anemic. They didn't have any GI bleeding. And so they were kind of very stable, not sick ITP patients. So worth considering in this sort of patient population specifically, but I'm not sure I could advocate its use in a sort of a more of a bleeding, unwell manifestation of ITP. And then another drug that we could contemplate using to treat these patients is human IVIG, or the human intravenous immunoglobulin, which is basically it's a transfusion product that consists solely of pooled immunoglobulin, predominantly immunoglobulin G. And it's supposed to work by decreasing autoantibody production and increasing the clearance of those sort of pathologic antibodies to try and decrease platelet clearance by the rogue immune system. There's doses reported in the literature, but the issue with it is it tends to be really cost prohibitive in a lot of patients, and so it tends to be reserved for those with really quite severe disease, so not terribly commonly used. If it is used, then a single dose has been shown in this study to speed up platelet recovery time and decrease the length of hospitalization whilst it's being safe and no complications seen. So it seems like potentially, considering isolation, there may be a role for it. But in a study where they trialled its use with them, they looked at patients receiving either prednisolone and IVIG versus prednisolone vincristine. There wasn't really any benefit to using IVIG over the vincristine choice. So given the latter is cheaper, more readily available, it seems like there'd need to be a specific justification for its use to justify using it over vincristine potentially. I wanted to mention platelet transfusion as a sort of more band-aid or sort of plaster-like treatment of ITP to see if there's an indication for it. And usually we'll think about transfusing platelets in veterinary medicine as a sort of therapeutic intervention where it's indicated for the management of either uncontrolled or life-threatening bleeding because of thrombocytopenia. And usually we'll think about areas where the bleeding is affecting a major body system like the brain or the lungs, or an area of the body such as the GI tract where it's just really difficult to achieve hemostasis if we're bleeding there, and that can be quite a difficult source to control bleeding from and can result in a patient bleeding out with us being asked to do very little about it. But we do sometimes think about prophylactic platelet transfusions if we have a patient with severe thrombocytopenia, for example, that we're considering sort of taking to surgery. So potentially a couple of indications for it. In terms of options that we have, we're somewhat limited, to be honest. So in the States, then, there is access to frozen platelets, which there's some evidence to say there's maybe some very short-term hemostatic effect, but a very kind of poor survival of these platelets beyond initial transfusion. So probably better than nothing in the moment, but isn't going to fix things for the long term. And of course, very difficult, if near impossible, to kind of access over in the UK and other places outside of the States. It is possible to make platelet products, and certainly that's what would happen in human medicine, but it does require the services of a blood bank and is fraught with some technical challenges given how fragile platelets are. And with every kind of step that we take in making specific platelet products, we are losing platelets just by virtue of us trying to kind of preserve them. Which essentially means that if we want to give platelets to our small animal patients, then we're thinking about giving them in the form of a fresh whole blood as the least tampered with kind of way to administer them. And also has the potential benefits that it's administering red cells and clotting factors as well that could have been lost or depleted by bleeding. So pretty uncommon that we need to kind of go with platelet-specific transfusion. But as I said, if we have patients with life-threatening bleeding, we can consider it. The difficulty may be in the time that it takes to obtain that blood. If it's genuinely life-threatening bleeding, we may have lost our patient by that point. So platelet transfusion, good if it works, if it's truly indicated, but not the easiest thing to do. I did want to mention, in the grand scheme of things, we alluded to the fact that there's sort of some ITP patients are worse than others. Is there anything in the literature to say which are actually the ones that we should worry about more? And there was this study that showed it's dogs with the presence of GI bleeding, so melena or a high BUN, probably as a marker of sort of GI bleeding, had a worse prognosis borne out in this study. So it's not to say that we would necessarily change what we do with those dogs. I don't think we have the evidence to say that, but maybe they're the ones that we should be more worried about potentially and have on our radar a bit more. And so really, in the absence of anything in the literature to say what is best, all I can present to you as a recommendation is how I tend to do it, sort of based on experience and talking to colleagues and sort of trying a few different things to see what works best. And so you said steroids, absolutely the mainstay, prednisolone or dexamethasone, depending on how the patient is as to whether they can take oral medications. Tend to use vincristine as a single administration once to try and get that platelet recovery up as soon as possible. And then just sticking with the two of those in most patients. Adding azathioprine for larger dogs where I specifically would want to reduce the dose of the steroid. And then again, using that sort of decision, that clinical judgment on the individual patient to decide if doxycycline or GI protectants are indeed indicated. In terms of sort of managing them longer in terms of ITP, then how do we define success? How do we know we're kind of getting somewhere? Well, usually, unless the dog is completely crazy or a dog or cat is completely crazy and I feel like they're going to do themselves more harm than good in a hospital situation, we'll often be hospitalized until their platelet count does exceed the level at which I'm no longer worried about spontaneous bleeding. And in order to think about weaning them off the immunosuppressive therapy, then the platelet count should be up within the normal range. Once they're at that point, then there's lots of different strategies that people can use for weaning them off the drugs, but a commonly used one is to reduce the steroid dose by sort of 25% of that additional dose every 3 weeks, checking the platelet count sequentially after each reduction just to make sure that it's still within the normal reference range. Something that's caught me out a few times is that because steroids are associated with increasing platelet counts a little bit, because they do reduce removal of senescent platelets, it is normal as we'd reduce the dose of steroids, we will have a small drop in the platelet count, but that should still remain within the normal range. And if it doesn't, then that probably represents a relapse as opposed to just a side effect of the dosing decrease. And as with IMHA protocols, in terms of weaning, if they're on a second agent, we'll tend to get rid of all of the steroids first and then discontinue the second line agent as our last thing that we do. So moving on to thinking about those other causes of thrombocytopenia that we touched on earlier. I wanted to mention sequestration of platelets as the next thing we talked about as being another significant cause of thrombocytopenia. And it tends to be an issue with the spleen more so, because in health, then up to sort of 30 or 40% of our normal platelet pool can actually be stored in the spleen. So if there's some kind of issue, disease with the spleen, whether that be neoplasia or torsion or splenic enlargement, congestion, etc., we can lose a lot of circulating platelets to the spleen. I wanted to mention this specifically because indeed, earlier in this webinar, I said that usually the severe platelet counts were more likely to be associated with immune-mediated disease. Very occasionally, that can happen with splenic torsion as well, potentially because of sequestration as well as consumption, as well as fluid therapy and various other factors. But that degree of thrombocytopenia could be completely corrected. Certainly, there's this report of two dogs with really severe thrombocytopenia that underwent splenectomy. One had some platelet product, one didn't at the time of surgery. Both of them had a rapid return of a platelet count within 4 days and were discharged from the hospital at that time. So worth mentioning that as another cause of significant thrombocytopenia. And then thinking about consumption, even if we have a bleed because of a reason unrelated to a coagulopathy, so for example a trauma or bleeding neoplasm or something similar, then we know that in trying to stop that bleeding, the body is going to use up some of those platelets and clotting factors it normally has, and in doing so induce its own thrombocytopenia. But in isolation, it's worth bearing in mind that that should be a mild change, and so it would be very unlikely that our platelets would drop into that sort of spontaneous risk range. But it could perpetuate ongoing bleeding if it did become severe. So it's worth bearing in mind what's likely to come first, the sort of the coagulopathy or bleeding and then coagulopathy. And consumption of platelets, a sort of decreasing counts on serial monitoring, could also be a sign of thrombosis in the patient who's not bleeding, again, as sort of those platelets are being consumed elsewhere in the body. A sort of second cause of consumption of platelets is the presence of DIC, or this disseminated intravascular coagulation. And this is maybe a term we've heard in relation to patients with systemic inflammation or sepsis, sort of like the big players in that, whereby we have something that's upregulated the coagulation system, causing widespread clotting, which then uses up everything, causes the thrombocytopenia, and then causes bleeding. And in a nutshell, there's no quick way to fix this. If the patient is actually bleeding, then we're treating with blood products supportively for that. But the crux of this is to try and treat the underlying disease, which, of course, in the presence of systemic inflammation, is easier said than done. And the other thing that can sort of consume or use up platelets in a similar sort of fashion is the presence of dilution. So if we have a patient who's receiving high doses of intravenous fluids that are not containing fresh whole blood, as is usually the case with our standard fluid therapy, we know that can dilute out platelets and clotting factors are there. And if given massive volume, so for example, after a sort of high volume fluid resuscitation, like in trauma, would be sort of one of the classic ones, we can induce a sort of dilutional coagulopathy. But again, we're talking about similar numbers as we talked about with hemorrhage. And so usually, again, from history and so on, we can tell sort of which came first. Just to finish up with the other sort of categories of causes of thrombocytopenia, so if there's a decrease in production of platelets, and we know platelets are made in the bone marrow from the megakaryocytes, and so conditions whereby there's a disruption to that process can cause an issue with platelet production. If we look at this list of bone marrow disorders, things like leukemia or sort of the pre-leukemic states of myelodysplasia or the others that are listed there, then they're not specifically targeting the platelet precursors, and so for that reason we'll often see other cell lines being affected with non-regenerative anemias or decrease in white blood cell counts too. And so looking on our blood smear or hematology for those factors might clue us into, say, a bone marrow is more likely. And if that's the case, then we'll typically think about sampling the bone marrow to look for what might be there, whether that be a core and hopefully an aspirate and a core biopsy as well. And then seen less commonly, there are several infectious diseases that have been associated with the presence of thrombocytopenia as well. And as mentioned before, it could be that they're triggering the immune system to develop ITP. Certainly that's the case that's been reported with Ehrlichia and anaplasma. But a lot of the others listed, so the sepsis, babesia, leptospirosis, FIP, etc., are all things that are associated with a vasculitis and therefore could just be a consumption. So it's worth thinking about patients with thrombocytopenia if any of the clinical signs fit this, if there's a history, the geographical location they're from, to see whether or not they might be implicated or not. And then to finish up, a talk on sort of differentials wouldn't be right if we didn't mention neoplasia sort of specifically. And we can see in various neoplastic states, we can see consumption of platelets, maybe in bleeding, but also in patients such as those with hemangiosarcoma of the spleen, as sort of mentioned in this study. We could see some sequestration effect. We can see some dilution from fluid therapy. So lots of reasons that patients with neoplasia could develop some thrombocytopenia. And I wanted to kind of mention this study as we're coming to a close, that that looking at a selection of anemic dogs with a splenic mass and hemoperitoneum that's bad enough to warrant a transfusion, they found that the dogs that were ultimately diagnosed with hemangiosarcoma had significantly lower total solids and lower platelet counts at admission, which, when I read this study, I thought that was quite interesting, because it raises the question, could this be used as sort of a diagnostic tool down to the sort of level of the actual diagnosis of neoplasia? And that would be quite a nice thing if that were the case. However, somewhat unsurprisingly, it didn't really pan out to be true. So they looked to see whether or not you could use a platelet cutoff of less than 90,000 cells prognostically to say, was it likely to be hemangiosarcoma as opposed to some other splenic lesion? And using a cutoff of this 90,000, then it had a positive predictive value of 92%, meaning that if the platelet count was less than 90,000, then we can be 92% certain that it was hemangiosarcoma. So suggestive, but again, not 100%. And I think we'd probably all be thinking that the patient with the splenic mass with the heme abdomen could have hemangiosarcoma anyway, so I'm not sure it necessarily adds that much. On the flip side, the negative predictive value was 42%, so if the platelet count was greater than 90,000, you can still only be 42% certain that it wasn't hemangiosarcoma. And I think the figure that I've included here from the paper shows this lack of usefulness quite nicely, in that it shows the platelet counts for patients with hemangiosarcoma versus other splenic lesions, and there's just too much overlap there for that to be in any way useful at all. And the final thing to consider, again, in this country, really can't forget lungworm as a cause of bleeding. And it's a bit of a tricky one, because it can cause bleeding that can resemble primary hemostatic disorders or secondary hemostatic disorders or any or all of the above. And truth be told, we still, although a lot of people have looked into a lot of different aspects of coagulation, we're not really any further on in saying how this parasite actually causes clinical bleeding. So even though we can pin down bleeding disorders to maybe look like a primary disorder, it's always worth considering lungworm as a differential for that on that list. And again, Regardless of the actual cause of the coagulopathy, there's always some general principles of handling these animals that can come in to be relevant, just to try and prevent any situation getting worse, whilst hopefully one of the more specific treatments that we talked about today is kicking in and being effective. And so hopefully that's answered some questions that you had today about how you approach patients with thrombocytopenia, and hopefully having covered the sort of the common causes, spending a little bit of time kind of looking at what the latest kind of thinking is on those. Hopefully that's helped to manage some of those tricky patients that come in. Thank you for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Lindsay for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.